putting this whole scene together as I'm looking at it. There's
one of the ways that we've spoken about this episode, what the chait of the Ragma was. So, because we spoke about the fact that the Zohar says that their chait was that they understood that they were not going to be the Nesiim when they came into Israel, because that wasn't their strength. They knew that their current office would be taken from them because they were the right leaders for a generation that was removed from worldly affairs. But the moment that they were going to enter Israel and have to deal with a very demanding practical world, a world of building houses and plowing farms and planting tomatoes and making beads and selling fabric and being tailors and blacksmiths, they were not capable of the leaders of that kind of a society. I think the way most people understand this is not that this was an upfront awareness of theirs, that they knew that they needed to conspire against the people or conspire against Moshe Rabbeinu. They should have been sensitive to the fact that there's some other motive working in them. And that sensitivity should have derived from the assurance that Hashem had given them that the land was a beautiful land, that it was a land that He had promised them and was going to deliver to them. And therefore, when they went in, they should have been seeing all the many good qualities that they could bring back. Instead, they were seeing all kinds of frightening things. Now, that should have tipped them off that something is wrong. Here you have Hashem's assurance. Here you have all of these promises. A land that is the only possibility that they should fulfill all of these agricultural mitzvahs, which they can't fulfill in the desert. They should be seeing the good. Why are they not seeing the good? Then they could have sat down there and said, why am I not seeing the good? And then they could have responded to themselves, I must have some ulterior motive. They would have figured it out, and then they could have compensated for it. Instead, they went with it. So they're held responsible for it. That's a famous story with Abdulov, who was the presiding judge in a Beis Din. And there were two litigants who were arguing their cases in front of them, and two of the judges were arguing. One particular litigant was the one who had the better case, and the Abdulov was arguing that the other litigant was the one who really was in the right place, and that this fellow was in the wrong for a variety of reasons. In any event, he was trying to persuade them, and he was having a difficult time. Meanwhile, this litigant, this particular litigant who Abdulov felt was in the wrong, understood somehow from the way he saw the Abdulov in his questions that the Abdulov was the one judge who he needed to convince. So when the judges were in session, when the basin was in session, he picked himself up and walked out and walked over to the Abdulov's house and asked if he could be there for a little bit. Nobody knew what he was about, and he kind of sat down when he had an opportunity. He walked over to the closet and put a bag of money into one of the pockets of the Abdulov's bekishes. So abruptly, during the proceedings, the Abdulov began to feel that the arguments of his associates were making sense. And as that feeling progressed, became more and more puzzled, and he asked for a recess. So he walked out, and he's thinking to himself, what happened here? Up until a short time ago, he was absolutely convinced this guy was in the wrong, and how is it? So he decided he'd go home for a bite. Comes to the house, and he said to his Rebbetzin, was anybody here in my absence? So she said, yeah, this fellow. So he said, well, what did he want? So I don't know. He just sat here like he was waiting for you. The Abdulov began to look around, and then he walked over to the closet and began to look until he found this bag of money. So he took the bag of money and went back into Beis Din. Some of the litigants handed him back the bag of money. And he turned to his associates and he said, take a look at how powerful shochad is. A bribe can affect the person even if he doesn't know that he's received it. That's how powerful a bribe is. And there is no greater bribe than covet. And if a person understands, nothing makes sense here though. Ben Shalom says to him, the land is a land that flows with milk and honey, and I'm going to escort you into the land. And why am I seeing these things? That should have tipped him up. They should have stopped and said,
honor.
And the person begins to think about what kind of honor they're going to get. It destroys a person's objectivity. They look at it through a totally different lens. So they're held responsible. They come back with this report on the eighth day of Av. So on that night, everybody, the nation, wept. And Hashem said to them, you wept for nothing. This fixes this day in history because of the report, and that they felt that they were being set up to be slaughtered. So Hashem said, you wept for nothing. So this day will be a day in which you won't weep for nothing. And not only the fact that it was the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed twice on that day, but there were all kind of horrific events that occurred to
Jews
once throughout.
Archduke Ferdinand was assassinated that day, starting the First World War, which was really
all kinds of stuff that happened on Tisha B'Av. It's reminiscent of the story. There was a concert that was being given by some celebrated young new star violinist. Of course, all the great musical artists attended this concert, and during one of the intermissions, I think it was Isaac Stern, the violinist, turned to the fellow sitting next to him, who was one of the great pianists, and said to him, my, it really is quite warm in here. And the other fellow said, well, not for us pianists. So these kind of stories do make us uncomfortable. In the past, one of the things that I added to this story was that the fact that they chose these princes of the tribes to be scouts, and I have to believe that people did not become Nisim at age 20, and that the greatest likelihood is that these were people in their 50s, 60s, and perhaps their 70s, that they were older people. These were Nisim. They were people who had a reputation of longstanding righteousness. So why would they choose Nisim? If anything, if the United States Army wanted to send a group of spies into a place, they would choose some people who were very strong, very agile, very young. But people could run and jump and quick reflex. They wouldn't go looking for them at their Jewish home for the agent. Or at scouts, I don't know. So it seems to me perhaps one of the reasons that they chose these kinds of people as opposed to a bunch of young, agile whippersnappers is because the question was not just simply go there and check out, do they have fortified cities and great warriors? The real question over here was, till now we know that Klal Yisrael receiving a freebie. We went out of Egypt not because we were all righteous, but because Hashem had to get us out of there before we were going to totally lose our identity. And because we did not have a Torah, Hashem dealt with us like we were infants, and it was all undeserved attention and free lunch. But once we received the Torah, there's no free lunch anymore. Now we're only going to get what we have earned, what we deserve. So we need for someone to go in to Eretz Yisrael and judge the magnitude of the challenge that we're going to face and measure it against our spiritual capacities to make ourselves worthy of the miracles that it will take to conquer the land.
But God has already said that it's going to work.
It's going to work, but evaluation is that it will work by virtue of the fact that they will make themselves worthy of it. And to some extent, that's true, that they need to be in a place where what happens measures up to who they are. So the spies, the scouts, the Moroccan go, they see Eretz Yisrael, they see that it is, in fact, a magnificent land, the fruit. In order to carry a cluster of grapes back, you need 8 people to carry it back. and that it's a land that encourages giants and all kinds of bigger-than-life phenomena. So they come back, and they say to themselves, you know what? There's no question God can make this happen in a heartbeat. The spiritual level that Klal Yisrael needs to be at is so great, so as to be worthy of what it's going to take. That's why they needed these kinds of people. They needed people who understood where Klal Yisrael was at spiritually. The only ones who had that sense were people who had been around, people who were the teachers of Klal Yisrael and who were the elder members. They sent a group of senior citizens there. But they came back and they said, this will take a very great people. And here's where the chet came in. They said, we're not them and we can't be them. We're not capable of becoming them. Certainly not in a few months. You know, Hashem wants us to go in. This will take us years to get there. If. So they said, this land is stronger than us. And maybe that was, at one level, was a reasonable judgment. But the chet was that they underestimated the nation and they undermined the nation's confidence in their own ability to become. And that was a terrible thing to do. You don't come and tell a person you can't get there. A Jew can get anywhere.